So I assume you guys are all here to learn about special reality, right? Okay, great. So we're going to do it pretty free form. If you guys have questions during the panel at all, please feel free to ask them. We encourage questions. We're going to go down. We're kind of going to bounce down, let everybody kind of intro themselves so you get to know them. Then we're going to come back through. We're going to do demos. And then we're going to really leave it open to questions unless we have some time in between. So I'm going to start here with Mr. Alan Doyle with MIT Museum.
Okay. Is this thing on? Can you hear me? Okay. So my name's Alan Doyle. I'm with the MIT Museum. And basically, I'm going to be telling you about a project we're working on called the Museum Without Walls. And I'll get into what it is later, but basically think walking around a campus or any place with a handheld device and picking up museum kind of stuff on it.
And then we have Mr. John Hankey with Google.
I'm the director of our mapping products, so Google Earth and Google Maps and Local Search. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about how we're building out what I think of as kind of the substrate for this kind of living in a virtual reality world, and that is the model of the world itself. And hopefully we can get into that a bit.
I'm Dan Dubnow. I was with CBS News for many years, and now I have my own company called Blowing Things Up. What I am interested in talking about is my passion and vision for how this technology is going to revolutionize our world, certainly, and show you some examples of how it's done it in news, but really bring you to hopefully embrace my sense or my dream of where this technology is going. And I guess I'm a booster, and I'm willing to take anybody on if you think I'm too optimistic. I hope you set me straight. But anyway, there's a passion that I have for this, and I hope to share it with you.
My name is Frank Robles. I'm the CEO of Neapolitan Networks. For the last few years, we've been doing a lot of back-end systems on Google Earth and several projects with John and Dan, in fact, and we hope to show some of those today.
My name is Gina Bianchini, and I run a little company called Ning, and we're looking to give people, regular everyday people, the opportunity to use this technology in new and interesting ways.
And with that, we'll start in with the presentations.
Am I first?
Yeah, Alan.
Okay. All right. Let's hit play mode here. Okay, so basically my project is Museum Without Walls, and think something about this size, and let me get into the presentation. The MIT campus is sort of a good-sized university campus. There's 20,000 people there. It's 168 acres. Key thing is there's 2,800 Wi-Fi access points. There's about 70,000 people who come, like official visitors. They come to the museum, or they're prospective students and their parents, or they're there for a conference. The space itself is this very complex three-dimensional space, and it's very easy to get lost. There's 190 buildings, and it's 146 years old, which is key because the 150th anniversary is coming up in 2011, and that's actually causing the MIT administration to be willing to fund a nice high-tech way of getting around the campus. So that's proving to be sort of a bit of a financial engine for our project. What happens at a place like that is that everybody goes through and they experience it differently, if you're a student or if you're a staff member or whatever. And so the thing to think about is the stories that get generated by people who are there. And so what I have next is I've sort of remixed. We ran a story workshop and had some students put together some of their stories. And I kind of remixed that. And then we have at the end a couple of official stories. And so here's this basically a minute and a half video just to give you an idea of what kinds of stories there are.
The first time I walked into the lobby of Building 7, I was taken aback by its grand, imposing architecture.
These days, environmental doomsday is on everyone's mind.
Sitting at my favorite desk in Hayden Library and looking at the sailboats through the window, I remember all the evenings I've spent in different libraries.
Are you lost?
I am, or rather, I was.
Every year in Lobby 7, the nerds of the nerds gather at noon on the third Friday in January. In 2006, I once again numbered among these nerds as I stood waiting to witness my fourth kickoff of the MIT Mystery Hunt.
A tall man with snowy hair loomed over the students in MIT's Lobby 7 in the spring of 2006.
We will begin our afternoon assembly with a selection, Adagietto Symphony 5 by Mahler, as performed by the MIT Symphony Orchestra in Prague in May 2000. Thank you.
Doc, maybe you can tell us what we have here.
Sure, Al. This is a disc to show how you can get motion pictures out of a series of still pictures.
So basically what you can imagine is that there's just, you know, an infinite number of those kind of stories that can be told about a place, and not just MIT, about any place. You know, it could be Austin, it could be, you know, some town in Switzerland. It really doesn't matter. What it boils down to is this notion of location-based storytelling. And so what we're trying to do with our project is we're trying to make it easy for people to contribute stories. Nowadays with iMovie and GarageBand and things like that, and sort of the equivalent on the Windows platform, it's becoming really easy for people to generate short and interesting stories. Then of course you need a place where you can store all those stories, and what we need to do is provide some software that makes it easy to upload your stories, sort of peg them to the specific location, and basically help you reference them in both space and time and do other kinds of tagging. And then you need some way of giving them to people so that when they're walking around, they can actually experience the stories. The little demo that we put together right now that if you want, I can show you later, show people individually later. All the content lives on here, which is, you know, a 2 gigabyte chip, but what we really want to be able to do is stream them down over the Wi-Fi connections that you're probably going to be using. One thing is, you know, what people don't immediately understand is that local search is doesn't give you a tour. You know, if I type in wind tunnel history into the MIT Google, I'll see the page on the left. When in fact, the wind tunnel history is, you know, it's much richer than a page of things that come back. So in some sense, when you're putting together a tour, you're really curating, you're putting together a story. The key characteristics are we want this thing to be completely device independent. We want to have onboard navigation and location awareness. You know, you have to be able to go through this really complex space. You have to help people with accessibility issues. You should be able to tell people where the restrooms are, when the shuttle's running, things like that. And you should be able to either lead them around or make them feel safe in terms of just going around and exploring and know they can find their way back. Think of Tour 2.0. So we want to also have bookmarks, save your tracks, do some kind of locative social networks so that you could have, say, family and they could spread out and find each other. Or maybe even have people on the same tour actually be able to talk to each other, you know, through some kind of IRC or something. You want people to be able to upload, give comments, ratings, reviews. You know, if you like this lecture hall, you'll really like that lecture hall and stuff like that. We want to be able to build your own tour. You want to be able to say, I have 30 minutes. Show me all the interesting architectural bits of MIT. Or I'm 8 years old and I'm interested in robotics. Show me labs where I can go in and they'll actually explain something to me. And, you know, right now we have some sponsors, but we're looking for more. we can use both cash and technology. But I do want to, you know, thank Nokia for providing us with devices. And right now most of the money is coming from MIT, but we need to raise a lot more. And some URLs and a way to get in touch with me. Okay. And I'm right. Yeah, he's on here.
So yeah, as I mentioned, I just want to talk a little bit about what we're doing with community and sort of, I guess, collaborative map making, collaborative world building. The idea being that I think once we have this world, some really interesting stuff can happen. Just a little bit of a timeline. I came over with a little company called Keyhole. We were acquired by Google a couple of years ago. Our technology became Google Earth. Over the course of the past couple of years, we've had, you know, tremendous adoption of Earth and of Maps. We have over 200 million unique users who've downloaded and activated Google Earth today. And perhaps even more interestingly, over 30,000 developers out in the world that are making mashups with Google Maps, which is, you know, really interesting because you have all this content that wasn't maybe geo-referenced before that's now being geo-referenced in the form of these mashups. So it's really interesting to think what, you know, what are we going to be able to eventually do with that? You know, Google Maps is going to be on the iPhone. So, you know, really getting this stuff out into the situation where people can access it while they're moving around is tremendously interesting to me. And this virtual tour, I think, sort of fits right into that. You know, it all starts, you know, in my opinion, with having kind of this nice sort of working surface for people to begin authoring on top of. And for us, it's the satellite imagery base map. So the point I wanted to make here is just that we now have this extensive global coverage of high-resolution imagery. We have an exclusive partnership with Digital Globe, which operates the highest-resolution commercial, non-military remote sensing satellite. Has sub-meter accuracy imagery, which means a pixel is about roughly this big, so you can make out man-made structures, cars, things like that. And we now have coverage for about a third of the land surface of the Earth. So the land surface of the Earth is about 145 million square kilometers. We have about a third of that covered with high-resolution data. And that means about half of the people on the entire planet now have high-resolution data of their home, of their hometown, of their village, of their house. So these people can then begin to tell us about the place that they live. So sort of the second key step was for us was to basically use a very, very simple piece of software. It's just a repurposed BBS software. I think, licensed this for like $180 and put it on an old server and launched it a few years ago. And let people start tagging locations that they knew about. And today we have over 1.5 million places around the world that have been mapped by users. This map is an example of Bangalore, India. So in Bangalore, in fact, for all of India, Google doesn't really have any information on our servers that we sort of own and control about anything other than the imagery. So we put the imagery up, and then the people started mapping out their homes and communities. So, you know, all the shopping centers, universities, all the important points of interest are now mapped. And this is happening around the world. The sort of next thing in terms of the evolution of this thing that we've started to call the GeoWeb is reaching out to sort of existing established web sites, owners of content that's out on the web. And we're working with them to create a geo-referenced feed of that data so that you can lay it easily on top of a map. So what I'm showing here, and you can access this in this area in Google Earth called Featured Content. It'll be available in Maps soon. But things like Panoramio. So this was a site where people could basically mash up photos with the map and apply a latitude and longitude tag to those photos. We thought that was really interesting, so we added it to the Google Earth base map. They started with 50,000 georeference photos. They have over 1 million georeference photos today, so it's just really exploding. And I think it's going to be a really important part of kind of the basic layers of maps in the future. Wikipedia is another great example. You know, wonderful content around the world. It's, you know, a great resource to sort of search. But I think it's also really useful to see in the context of a map. I mean, if you're visiting a city you haven't been to, you can pull up all kinds of interesting historical information about buildings and places. And it's just great to have that browsable on a map. So that's now part of Google Earth today as well. More mundane things like restaurant reviews. So Yelp is a great community site, you know, awesome reviews of restaurants and bars and nightlife and things like that. So we've worked with them to expose their data as a Google Earth feed. So you can now browse all of their reviews. So you can fly down to Austin and you can see sort of this Yelp layer with all the little red Yelp pins sort of arrayed across the city. And you can see, you know, obviously, you know, big density around 6th Street and other kind of pockets around town. And then you can dive in and explore those neighborhoods. So they're really excited about it. It's a great way for people to get exposed to their content through the map and through the browsing experience. And the kind of the final step for us is then building out, you know, real 3D so that you're not just looking at the world from above, but so that you can drop down to that street level view and walk through it like a video game. And this is a really challenging problem. It's difficult to create nice looking three-dimensional models from automated techniques. And so what we did is we bought a company with a very easy to use 3D authoring tool, and we gave it away to the world. That tool is called SketchUp. Anybody can download it for free. It's like Mac Paint for 3D. It's incredibly easy to use. And we just, in addition to making it free, we put a button in it that lets it work with Google Earth, so you can pull over the georeferencing information, you can pull over the satellite imagery base map, and then you can begin sketching on top of it. And then with a single button press at the end of the process, you can then submit that model to Google. And so we're seeing many thousands of these models now flowing in, and they're being integrated into the base map. So we're starting to see really this true virtual reality world being created kind of before our eyes by users. So we see a 2D orthophoto like this. This is the Ferry Building in San Francisco. Very interesting, very useful perspective on that particular area. But when we add the textured 3D building, we get just that next level of realism. Finally, cities and governments are getting into the spirit. So cities around the world want their city to be represented well in these three-dimensional mapping products. So this was just launched. This is the city of Berlin. It's 40,000 modeled textured 3D buildings depicting basically every important structure in the city of Berlin. So they made this and are serving it up as a layer for Google Earth. And it's just incredibly detailed. So, we had this vision that this sort of community-authored 3D world could work, and it's just amazingly gratifying to see it coming into existence. So I think I'll stop there, hopefully we'll get into some discussions about, well, what can happen with this model of the world once it exists.
Thanks, John. Dan, you ready?
Well, John is a hero of mine because he made it happen. Years ago, and I'm talking about a decade ago, Al Gore had a really important speech. It was toward a digital Earth. And it was really a great speech that he made, and loved it and thought it was wonderful. And I attended dozens and dozens, felt like hundreds of discussions in which government officials were all talking about basically what John and his colleagues built. And I attended these discussions with the great hope that as a popular tool, we in the news media, and I was working in special events at CBS News where we're in charge of putting on wars on television and putting on political campaigns and using new technology to illustrate what was going on. But my secret goal was to come up with as many technologies as possible to democratize information, to make people have information that's important to understanding what's going on in the world around them available and accessible on a very individual basis, which I suppose is antithetical to a network, which I suppose wants to connect all the information and coalesce it in one discrete place. My goal was, let's give it away for free to everybody. So I was really excited when John's software, as it was Keyhole, was available. And we had a wonderful time engaging with them and finding data sources that we could share and learning a lot of painful lessons along the way. Because when you start dealing with satellite imagery, first of all, you don't get a whole lot of it. You get a little of it, and you get patches of it. And you'll see, even now, no matter how beautiful John's world is, and it is beautiful, there is a kind of patchwork look to the Earth. And there are places that are heavily represented with incredibly high-resolution satellite imagery. There are places that are heavily represented with aerial photography, which is often in higher resolution. And there are areas that have only 15 meter per pixel imagery. And when I say only, 10 years ago, it was unthinkable that we would get a coherent database that would have all of that stuff in one place. Why was it so important? Well, if you have earthquakes, you want to show people where those earthquakes are, and you want to let people know precisely where the fault lines are and where the event took place. And we were dreaming of putting that material on top of these base maps. If you have a nuclear test in some place, you want to show that imagery. The more places on the Earth that are accessible, available, and observable by the general public and by the journalists, it's a terrific tool not only to understand things, but to allow people to make their own decisions, their own understandings about what's going on. But something magical happened that I don't think anyone could have anticipated. And I think that John was riding on a fascinating tiger. The folks who run his company, when I showed them this software and other people showed them this software, they saw Sergey, Larry, they saw this as a really cool tool to present maps and all. But I think they realized that in terms of searching, it was a revolutionary technology. I'm not even sure they understood that Google Earth and other programs like it, I am attempting to be agnostic in this field, but it's hard because I admire what they did so much. But I believe that we are at the dawn of a new browser. You see, this is my lousy browser on my computer screen, and it's got these icons, and they don't make any sense to me. And this is the browser that I like, a geographical browser. And what that means is that I can start putting information on my geographical browser, and people are putting geographical information on their browser of all kinds. So there was a big earthquake the other day, and I'm interested in earthquakes, but what's happened in the past couple of minutes? So I don't know. There's this no-named earthquake someplace. Working with Frank, working with John, it was my desire to make a democratic tool to let everybody see where all the earthquakes were in real time. So this is an earthquake that took place rather recently. We can connect and see the data, and anybody can have access to it. Years ago at CBS, we developed a very expensive, very file not found, USGS, thank you very much for your genius. Working with the government has been such a delight in this regard. They change their file structure almost every week, and you can commend them for their excellent work. But anyway, the idea that every real-time earthquake, for example, can be mapped, you know, earthquakes, why should I care? Well, you guys live in California. I live in New York. And I understand. So when a terrible earthquake happens of devastating quality in some place that I happen not to be living at, I want to know exactly not only where the epicenter is, but where the actual effect of this earthquake will be. And one of the marvelous things that we recently created that works on Google Earth is something called shake maps. And for those people who are in California and sophisticated about earthquakes, they may know what it is. But for those of you who don't, what you can now do, instead of just pointing out the little dot on the Earth where an earthquake took place, is in real time, when a terrible earthquake comes up, we can show a three-dimensional vision of where the shaking did its devastation. So you're sitting at home, you hear there's an earthquake, you go on this software program, and you see the shake map. You're looking at almost real-time data before the cops and fire department in some place, finally get there to see this devastation. The power of this technology for news is extraordinary. Before, we were showing an epicenter that was 100 kilometers down. Now, we're showing areas, and I can say 44th and Main is devastated according to this computer simulation, and it isn't so bad on the west side or the east side. Okay, kind of a trivial thing perhaps to some people, but where I'm taking this is we're starting to put other things on it that are kind of interesting. This is in real time, and I'm bringing up, and hopefully it too will work. I'm fetching real-time news stories. The logos are popping up finally? Yeah, okay. So here's some top stories that have just been put online. And imagine all your news being served up on a map. Right now, it's a very generic top stories in U.S. and the world and, you know, in little countries. But imagine waking up in the morning and having incredibly precise street map where every bit of information that you need about your neighborhood. I like to know in my neighborhood what happened at school, in my daughter's school. And if it can be presented on a map in front of me, that transforms the entire interaction of my computer so that we're really seeing our news where the news is taking place. It's a transformational technology. Even though it started out as being a neat way to see where traffic is in real time or figuring out where the nearest, you know, Starbucks is, as it was discussed yesterday, what it really is providing an incredibly clear physical context to information that you, the public, and to everybody, a democratic process of where information is. Now, I'm showing you what is, and I want to tell you where I think we're headed, and I want to do it pretty quickly, so I hope hope that it's not that I'm more accurate than I fear I might be. How many of you have heard of CompStat? Anybody, by show of hands, CompStat? Okay, so we have a sophisticated audience, I suppose. Fundamentally, the notion is that you put cops on dots. You got crimes, you mark where the crimes take place on the map, and you send the cops to that area, and you hold them accountable. If a neighborhood has lots of dots around a store, that's where you target it. And it's not just mapping the crime data. It's actually demanding accountability by our law enforcement officials to see why is that neighborhood so oppressed by that crime and what can you do about it and why haven't you fixed it since last month when we showed the same number of dots on the map for crimes. What's remarkable is this technology experiment has, in my opinion, had the greatest impact on the severe reduction of crime across the country. It started out as a New York experiment. There are demographic reasons why crime has declined in certain areas. There are definitely staffing issues and other things. But when it comes to managing crime, now this is a huge part of my life. When I grew up, New York City was a terribly unsafe place. My block was a scary place, and I wouldn't go out at night to walk there. Now, because of mapping of all things, because of targeting, because of using data intelligently and holding people accountable, putting this information accessible ultimately on maps like this, we are changing people's physical lives, making my life safer. Let's not stop with the cops, even though cities around the country have been adopting that same policy, and they've been using those same tools, and ideally when government becomes more mature and we collectively pressure them into doing what's noble and right, which is putting that data accessible to all of us so that we all know whether I'm okay, I'm parking my car, let me look on my thing. Oh, five cars were stolen on this block, let me go to that block. I mean, that's the kind of data that I believe we have a right to. But it gets better, actually, because there's a new system in New York called 311. You may have heard of it. You got a garbage can overflowing. You got rats in the building. You got potholes to be fixed. You call up the 311 system. But imagine this. The politicians saw the effectiveness of CompStat, and they said, what if we apply the same basic things? What if we put all the problems people are having on maps, and then hold the people who are supposed to fix these problems accountable to it?
And what the problem with that is that everybody in New York would move to Austin if you guys did that.
Don't, you told me not to tell everybody. I'm from New York. I said to John, why don't we all live here? And he said, shh. But all I'm saying on this regard is I believe, very optimistically perhaps, but I believe it's true, that we are going to be able to see and demand much higher benefit from our government service providers and from other people with such maps. I want to conclude, and I've talked too much already, that, you know, obviously you'll be hearing more about the three-dimensional technologies and the ability to go into buildings and GPS stuff, which I love, and I want to chat endlessly about it, as you can probably see. But I really believe that I'm going to be walking around with a device that not only knows where I am and shows me where I am, because I have that right now on my phone, but I want to have a device that not only knows my location, and this is an opt-in thing that I want, but begins to negotiate on my behalf with vendors, okay? And someone said, well, I don't want to always know where Starbucks is. Well, I'm walking down the street, and maybe I want a cup of coffee, or maybe I want to buy a fish tank, and maybe I want to find out where this thing is. I want to talk to with something that is my personal agent, and it is totally within the obvious three-year timeline where we are going to have prototypical devices that will allow us not only to know where we are, know our interests, but negotiate on our behalf with vendors. And that, to me, is one of the most exciting aspects of this technology. There are many more. I would love to chat with you about more of them, but I want to be fair to my colleagues, so I will stop.
I'll be short.
Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it. Frank?
Can I get your...
Yeah.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions for Dan here in a few minutes.
No, he's on the same one. Yeah.
So our company has pretty much grown up with John's company. Originally it was Keyhole and now Google, of course. But one of the things that we've been doing all along is the back-end systems, helping to create databases and networks that can scale and keep up with the demand that people generate around the world. It hasn't been easy, often having to deal with both the demand but also denial of service attacks. I'm going to quickly show you a couple of projects that we've done and give you an example of what we're working on. And I also solicit projects. We're working on doing these with several different organizations, and we're looking for more. We started off working with Google Earth. I met John, 6 years ago or 7 years ago at a communications conference. And I saw it as a means to display my fiber networks. You know, my background is building fiber optic networks, microwave networks. And I was always looking a way to show that to people. Because it's hard to visualize. It's really hard to visualize fiber in the ground or microwave shooting through the air. And I'm trying to sell this to people, of course, and explain people and manage these networks. And it wasn't easy until I ran into John. And we spent a lot of time on that tool to integrate such things. Of course, later we ended up working on the USGS and CBS thing that Dan was showing earlier, showing earthquakes around the planet. I was going to try to demo it here, but the internet access is not too good, so it wasn't worth the trouble. But you guys get the idea. We're showing these earthquakes around the planet, as Dan carefully explained. But we update these things every 2.5 seconds. This is the important thing. And we see things. We got glimpses of the nuclear tests they did in Korea. We have the data where things happen in the ocean. And now I started working with the UN, and they're starting to link into that to give early warnings to some of these third worlds that are subject to that. So that's what the idea of this panel even is, to focus the fact that we are living in spatial reality. This isn't just Web 2.0. I mean, this is actual stuff that people's lives are on the line. People matter. Location matters. Bringing those things together, like where the policeman is or where the cars got stolen, comes to play here. Another project that John was mentioning earlier is Panoramio. We do a lot of work on that project. They just updated the files. Now they're showing over 400,000 images. That's a lot of data. It's lots of rows of data. Usually, we think about the databases in 30,000 rows or less. 400,000 rows and growing dynamically is a lot of information they've got to scale. It's beautiful photos. I encourage you all to check out the site. The interesting thing about this is it's using some of the new protocols that Google Earth provides to allow it both visible in 2D and 3D. So thus working into the phones. One project that we haven't announced yet, I'll give you a little bit of highlight, and I was going to demo, but again, the internet access prevented me, is common alert protocols. Last summer, the president mandated a common alert protocol, a common protocol for people to share emergency information, things like floods, things like storms, things like yellow alerts, kidnapping or something of that nature. And we've begun working with several state organizations and government organizations to pull that data together to make it visible on Google Earth. And I hope to have that available soon. Finally, I'll show you a project that we
we're just about to release. These are tall buildings around the U.S. There's about 30,000 tall, glassy, Class A buildings in the United States, and we're starting to track, you know, where they're located. Not just making a 3D dimensional image, but what services are available. You know, we're going to have the photos of the buildings here, but also what network services you can buy there. You know, what communication carriers are in the facility. One of the things that I ran into is people will move into a building, and communications is always an afterthought, and when it becomes one of the most important matters. So again, this will be another service available via Google Earth. So as I said before, I solicit projects. We're working on more projects, and this is a growing part of our business. Thank you much.
Thanks, Frank. Gina?
How can you follow up from all of that?
Well, the social implications of all this.
I think one of the things that's really interesting is the fact that, you know, John, you were mentioning 30,000 developers creating map mashups today. And one of the things we're really trying to do with Ning is enable that number to be millions of people, putting it in the hands of non-technical folks or people who don't have the development expertise. And the types of things that we've seen, on Ning so far have just been, I would say, things that are really important to individual people and families. But I think what's so fascinating about where we're sitting right now is that this technology that you guys have all shown, which is just mind-blowing, especially in terms of the browser and what people can do with it, it's no longer in the hands of governments or even, you know, large technology companies or even startup technology companies. But it can be in the hands of every individual person with every great idea that they have. And I think that that's the part where we're still seeing the evolution of where we're going is into a world where everyone with a great idea can make that great idea a reality online today. So with that, I think we have some questions.
Well, I needlessly have like a dozen questions, but I can see a lot of people's eyes kind of lighting up out there, so I don't want to steal everybody's glory, but a couple of the questions I had were about, for the panel, accessibility issues, of course, with people with disabilities, because this is very visual stuff. And, of course, privacy concerns, which Dan sort of touched on a little bit. So, anybody?
Oh, all right, I'll go first. We've actually been putting some thought into the accessibility issue. One obvious thing is that you want to help people navigate a space if they're in a wheelchair or something. The other thing is, you know, if you have one of these devices, can we actually supply an experience, you know, for instance, just an audio experience where the video doesn't matter. So one of the parameters, if you put in, you know, I can't see, then maybe it wouldn't try to feed you stuff that was sort of visually important. And the other thing is, obviously, it also lends itself to different languages. So you know, not everybody speaks English, and you know that's something that people forget all the time.
Yeah, we're actually really lucky. One of the Google user experience designers is here, I know that we have some standards where we try to make things accessible kind of across the board. I mean, do you want to share with people kind of what we do in that?
We do a lot of testing, specifically. Google Maps. One of the great things about working on a product such as Google Maps and Google Earth is that we do really get clients from all over the world, and so we spend a lot of time making sure that we go out there and actually assess how we're meeting the needs of people in different countries and how they have different accessibility concerns. There are different standards that we really need to focus in on. Things like in China, it's really hard to do text input. That's an important thing, and it really helps guide the direction of our design. That this is one of those things that we continually try to check in on with different specific groups and in different areas that we assume that we know a lot about, but we also know that those are false assumptions. So we're able to proactively make the pads towards making a better product for all people.
Anybody else? How about privacy issues?
Well, I mean, someone said to you, oh boy, someone's going to get really upset with you because you're saying that you're going to have handheld unit that's going to know where you are and know what you want and know everything about you and know the decisions you make. And I mean, I just think that's like, you know, they've said privacy, get over it. But I don't think that it's a problem remotely. I think that these are going to be opt-in technology. These are going to be opt-in things, and the cost benefit that you're going to make a determination is you. This is your agent. It's going to be working for you. You're going to be telling it what you're interested in, and as long as you opt in. I don't really see what the downside is. I mean, there are people who live in places away from civilization who want to be left alone, who don't want to be contacted, and that is their right, and I respect that. There are other people who want services when they want them, in the way they want them, and if they have a handheld device and they have the option of having that device give them intelligent information, gee, I think they're going to want that too. And I mean, the thing about this museum is so incredible, it's giving you any kind of information that you're requesting. And if you don't want that information, don't turn it on. And you do have that same set of options, I believe, and we'll have them in this future device world. So in terms of privacy, as long as it's opt-in, as long as people aren't going around injecting you with chips.
Sort of the Minority Report effect.
Yeah, you know.
Hey, I would just say a couple things about the satellite imagery side of that, because some people, you know, have the misconception, I think, created by perhaps overeager journalists in some cases, but not Dan, that Google has the ability to zoom down and sort of, you know, spy on you or sort of track you. And that's not the case. The way these satellites work, they can just get a picture sort of every few days. If there aren't any clouds and so on. And you can't sort of get to the level where you can make out sort of individual features to like recognize a person. So I think some of the concerns that sometimes people have about sort of the eye in the sky are a little overblown. And, you know, the counterbalance to that whole discussion is that there's a hugely democratizing aspect to having this kind of information, as Gina said, be available to the people and not just to the government and the security organizations that have traditionally controlled this. You know, Google Earth and Maps were recently blocked completely in Bahrain, which is this principality in the Middle East. And we were blocked because the imagery showed clearly these vast estates that were controlled by the ruling oligarchy. And people, you know, sort of found this out online. People living in the country didn't know, like, what was going on in their own country. They didn't realize that large tracts of land were, in fact, controlled by the ruling class, where there were these huge mansions and pools and yachts and race courses and... it's really quite insane. So I think, you know, net is probably, you know, a really good thing for humanity for that kind of information to be out there and kind of in the hands of the public.
Yep. I would agree. Another question I had was, you know, this you talked to it, John, a little bit, and I think Gina did as well, sort of the importance of places changing. I mean, New York will always be New York, but, I mean, these communities that are just popping up out of nowhere, right? This information is out there. You can tag your place. You can build it, and all of a sudden BFE is important. So, do you have anything to add on that?
What's BFE?
But F Egypt.
Oh. Okay.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think what's fascinating is the fact that you when you have, you know, a little bit, as John said, that just this democratization of the data and the tools for communicating, the things that happen and the things that pop up are phenomenal. I mean, they're absolutely phenomenal. So.
But I think that one disappointment I've had is that with the 3D models of things, there is no really coherent vision. I love this guy. There is no really coherent vision beyond, I mean, Google has a brilliant approach. They bought SketchUp. It's an incredible tool. You can download it for free. I do. I use it. You can build your own house. You can import it into Google Earth. That's great. And you can go into things, and some of the models, I don't know if you showed everything, but you never showed everything, but John's approach is incredibly democratic. Build your own.
Yeah.
There is no rational way that some company is going to gather all of this and build all of this, and especially indoors, and put it available on the web. Now, Microsoft, on the other hand, wants to build all of this, take all of this, and put this on the web. And actually, they have some interesting small approaches that they've done, and they built, you know, a couple of cities, not completely, but they've done a few things. But the point is that my dream was a very great automated system would be out there sucking up the satellite imagery, aerial imagery, all of the various imagery forms, and merging it all together, and we would have very rapidly generated three-dimensional worlds that are there. And there definitely are astonishing projects, both in the world that we live in and the secret world, which needs it more than we do, which is doing to this a small degree. But the really amazing thing that I am hoping we'll see in 5-10 years, and I'm giving a very, I think, aggressive time point, and John would know better than I, is that I'm hoping to start seeing good interiors. So not only are we living in a virtual world with 3D buildings, but we're living in interior, we're seeing good interior spaces, similarly created in automated mechanisms. And then it will unlock even more power and for the consumer to see what's going on.
One thing about the changing nature that you're mentioning, Dean, mm-hmm. that I think many of us don't observe is we're thinking, looking at these tools, and we're thinking forward. We're getting information, we're adding information, so we're looking forward. But I was actually with some friends at MIT recently, and they did the reverse. They looked backwards. They took some ancient maps, I mean, hundreds of year old maps, and overlaid these things on cities. And it's amazing what you can learn. You know, where countries were, where borders used to be, where streets and buildings used to be. And that's very interesting, too, both in, you know, the virtual world, but also the 3D buildings, for us to understand our history and our culture and the rest of the world, not just our U.S., but other countries.
It looks like we have quite a few questions, Pop. Can you guys stand up by the mic so we can hear you, or if you're up close?
Hi, I'm Rakesh with Snapstream Media. This is a question for John. John, how compelling do you find a vision of Matrix-like, immersive lifelike experiences in a virtual world? Is that even something that you think is potentially valuable? And what do you see as the technology hurdles, the biggest technology hurdles to spatial virtual reality experiences like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tremendously compelling in The Matrix and in, you know, Neuromancer and, you know, all the sort of cyberpunk fiction. I mean, it seems incredibly compelling. I haven't yet seen, you know, a real manifestation of that that's as sexy and as gripping and as, you know, good as, you know, what I would like it to be, I think, to really sort of pull me in and have me invest a substantial portion of my sort of time, you know, in a space like that. But, you know, Second Life and, you know, just getting closer, I think there's some really interesting stuff out there. I think, you know, the technology is maybe still, you know, very, very bleeding edge to get that kind of nice experience. And modeling human avatars and human motion and interactions, it's just really hard to get that right without just a huge amount of compute and graphics horsepower and bandwidth. But, you know, Moore's Law, you can sort of project forward, and I think it'll happen. I think my kids will spend a tremendous amount of time in environments like that. You know, hopefully not too much.
Actually, could I just add something to that? There's almost a feeling of that nowadays. For instance, when I'm every once in a while, my kids get lost in downtown Boston or someplace, and it's usually at night. And they call me on the phone. And they say, "Dad, how do I get to wherever?" And so I pull up Google Maps, and I say, "Well, where are you?" And they say, "Okay, I'm here." And then I say, "Well, what kind of an area are they in?" So I pull up the satellite view, and I fully expect the satellite view to be dark because it's nighttime, and it's not. And so, you know, I think that there are little snippets of that that are coming along, and I think you have to also be careful that you understand sort of the veracity of what you're seeing. You know, are you seeing something that's really current, or are you seeing something that's just sort of a more like climatology as opposed to weather? You know, it's.
But you'll have choice, and you'll have choice on layered. This is the brilliance of what they've done is it's a layered system. So you can turn on real, you can turn on surreal, you can turn on whatever the heck you want. You can turn on news, you can turn on, it's all selectable.
Yeah, I agree.
Hey, it's Patrick Moorhead from Avenue A, Razorfish. So my question obviously is about monetization and advertising. That's what we're trying to figure out. for some of our clients. And I think that's maybe where the privacy question starts to come in from the public is, if you know all this stuff about me and where I am and what I'm buying and obviously all the data that we have about behavior that we use for marketing, so can you guys just address kind of your point of view on what you think the correct approach or a strategy for advertising and marketing around POI data and the kind of things you're doing?
Well, I mean, the Google perspective is this huge opportunity, you know, in the tens of billions of dollars for locally targeted ads. But we think that we get all we need to deliver, you know, really relevant ads to people based on the query itself. So we don't necessarily have to amass, you know, the life history of somebody to deliver a relevant ad. If somebody's looking for, searching for sushi restaurants in downtown Austin, Texas, that's enough for us, you know, and that's, you know, we don't consider it to be, you know, an invasion of privacy to then trigger an ad based on the query that's been submitted. So that's basically Google's model. And in terms of the ability to monetize on that, I mean, it's there, it's proven.
I also think that the nature of advertising hopefully is changing as well, where it's really becoming about giving people targeted and relevant information. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, and you see people bristle at banners that have nothing to do with anything that they care about. Yeah. But when you're, you know, looking at and participating in a social network around Santa Monica Beach volleyball, you know, and the ads on Santa Monica Beach volleyball are for Santa Monica and volleyball, that's additional information for somebody about a topic they care about. And I think that the data is certainly available, whether it's, you know, as John said, just based on what people are searching for or what the topic of the network or the community is about. So, I mean, I think that the nature of advertising is fundamentally changing for the better, and it's better for people because it's additional information. And that's where the level of detail and the ability to organize around, whether it's your location or whether it's your interest or whether it's anything else that you're passionate about, is absolutely critical, both because it's fun and it's relevant to you, but also because there's opportunities for everybody.
It's a change in advertising from saying you're reaching 100,000 people with this ad. Mm-hmm. You don't know whether or not they care for your product at all or use your product at all. Right. So you're reaching 10,000 people, and every single one of these people have an interest in your product.
Right.
Exactly.
That's all it is. Mm-hmm.
Jason?
So this is not really a question, but more of a, I guess, generation of more thought. But can you talk more about your thoughts on to the whole panel about the implications of education in third world countries and the implications that this type of technology can have on commerce?
Well, I think it's huge in my experience so far. When they first added Mexico, it was incredible because they basically don't have maps in many of those cities. And now they do. And that's made a huge impact both in education and commerce locally in the communities that I'm aware of.
That's assuming that there are inexpensive computers that people can access and the online, you know, networking is actually available as well.
I think education around the world has been vastly improved by the fact that now we can actually get a bird's eye view and an angular view, I suppose, of places that were completely inaccessible before. One of the cool things that's happened is because the satellite imagery companies now realize the news imperative, it is true that they do not update imagery on the fly. Nothing is real time. Nothing is ever real time. But one thing that has happened over the past 5 years is absolutely extraordinary is that we can get satellite imagery tasked and delivered within a 16-hour period of time. And that is a profound humanitarian plus, because when there are mudslides, that would take a rescue crew 4 days, as it took, to actually get to that area. And you can task it, visualize it, present it not only to the spooks, but to people who will influence government people to do something about this terrible thing.
First responders.
First responders. And not just first responders, but people who can, say, respond. It's an amazing transformation, and it's an internationalization of information that gets everybody into this smaller community we're all living in. So,
in terms of third world countries, is it MIT behind the $100 laptop?
Yeah, that's a spin-off of the Media Lab, and you know, it's they're going down possibly a fairly radical path as far as some people are concerned. I would also say that there's this whole leapfrogging effect where a lot of third world countries, for instance, are putting in mobile phone systems as opposed to landlines. And you have to realize that you can deliver spatial data without a map. You don't need a map. And so one of the really cool things that I've learned is happening is somebody who's, say, growing beans or coffee or something can use their cell phone to find out which place they should go to sell it, because they can find out where the prices are better. Because if you have to spend 6 hours, lugging your coffee beans to a particular market, and you show up and there happen to be 600 other people selling the same stuff, you're not going to get very much. And so there are ways of providing this information without needing to use a map. But you need the substrate. You need all the databases and the networks and everything else behind it.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned coffee. Just a brief comment on this. I mean, I think it's clearly a value to give maps to the world where maps haven't existed before. I mean, that's just knowledge that's incredibly useful in a variety of ways, including economic. Kind of flipping things around, a friend of mine runs a group called Fair Trade. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of it, but it labels things like coffee and chocolate that are produced by small growers. And he and I have talked about, what would the power be to a consumer if you could easily see for any good that you buy, exactly where it came from. And as I think as we begin to care more about where our stuff is made and trying to get, locally produced goods or goods that are produced by, small farmers versus large corporations, that could be an incredibly powerful use of this kind of mapping technology. And the pieces are there. The data is there. It's not really sort of fully exposed yet. But, that could have a profound effect on the developing world in terms of connecting people with suppliers and vendors and people making things globally. So I think there's a lot of exciting stuff yet to unfold.
We got another question here.
Hi, I'm Amy Vickers from Avenue A Razorfish as well. This has been a great panel, so thanks very much.
Thank you.
I take Gina's point that I pretty much take for granted that everything is popular, from a web development perspective, from a mapping and a data perspective, and the ideas are endless and tremendously useful. To the privacy point, though, they become most useful and most interesting when, through mobile devices, we can actually have information pushed to us based on our location. And there are still significant legislative issues around having that GPS information unlocked on our phones,
yeah.
Because they're currently only, our GPS locations are currently only available, right, to emergency personnel. So can you just speak for a little bit about the state of legislation in terms of opening up that data so that all the great ideas we are brainstorming can indeed become reality?
I don't think it's a legislative issue. It's really up to the carriers. And they have selectively unlocked that for their own services. Verizon has a Navigator service that you can buy for Verizon phones. But what they've not really done is open that up to third-party vendors, at least not very widely. And that's kind of true of all the carriers. But I really think it's an economic thing where they're really looking to maximize the profit from that service.
SMS,
and
yeah.
We're all hoping that they'll become more liberal in allowing us to access that data, because we all think that we could bring a lot of really creative services to bear.
And I've seen at least two, and I know there are more, opt-in technologies where your location, you are pushing out off your device to a service. So Verizon has limited it, but there is Navizon, for example, is one company. But there are other companies that you I know where my friends are. They know where I am. They know where I am because I'm pushing that stuff out. If they're already doing it, that's just one of several companies.
Yeah. Did you have a question as well?
Navizon is one, but there are several.
Yes, my name is Matt McBrook from Schematic in LA, and I couldn't agree more that once you tie data to physical locations, mm-hmm. you do create this sort of transformative way of searching and browsing data. I think we're all in agreement on that. I was wondering if the panel had any thoughts about the actual physical interfaces we use to experience this. Because we have, when you start tying data to physical space and physical relationships, we're all sitting here with laptops, walking down the street, whipping out your laptops, not particularly easy. PDAs, all of these things are based on internal metaphors, Windows icon, mouse pointer, that were for a different type of information browsing and information retrieval. So I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts about how interfaces, the actual human-computer interface, needs to evolve so we can experience this data in a more profound way, where the physical relationship we have with our device sort of ties with the experience of how we understand.
Are you going toward like the more immersive environment, like the virtual reality kind of?
Not at all. But for example, if I took my computer and held it up and was imagining that I was looking through it, I would sort of see a textual list of information. But if I put it down, it would make sense that it would become a map. Like these types of techniques. And I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts about that.
I'm not terribly offended by Google Maps on my BlackBerry right now, though it is still small. But I'm getting Google Maps right here, and I have satellite imagery available right on my handheld. So I'm not offended by that. Some of the smaller phones, I think it don't work brilliantly, but I mean, I'm seeing real-time traffic on this handheld device. I think that this form factor is the kind of size that, you know, it's a phone and carryable, and I think that anybody who has had the pleasure of seeing the Apple phone, I mean, I was cynical about it in verbiage until I had seen the actual thing, and I was blown away. I think it's going to be a delightful form factor.
Yeah, I probably read too much science fiction, but I mean, I totally believe in the kind of enhanced reality version where you're really getting additional information about the real world, you know, as you're looking around. And a lot of people have sort of mocked that up, and there's a guy named Mike Liebold who's associated with the Institute for the Future in San Francisco, which does sort of corporate visioning types of things, and he's created some very compelling graphics of what that might look like. And you see it, you know, written about as people are imagining, you know, in novels. There's a novel called Rainbow's End by this guy, Wim Wenders, and imagines that. Technology's not quite there. But, you know, it was, somebody said earlier, you don't necessarily need a map.
Right.
Yeah. Geospatial data is not necessarily about the map. If you're out in the real world, you want to see that augmentation of what's around you, to see through the walls, to see what the prices are, to see what the recommendations are from Yelp. Is this a good place? Should I go in or not? Personally, I'd love to see it, you know, hopefully in the next few years.
John, I'm sorry to cut you off. They're compressing us here, and they're going to give us one more question, and then we'll be out in the hall. So,
my name is Marshall Kirkpatrick. I think there's a lot of neat feel-good anecdotes available here, but I'm curious why the rest of the world should trust us. You know, I fully believe that crime zones will be mapped, but that's probably much more likely than police precincts that have seen convictions for police brutality or planting drugs. Are going to be mapped, and places, you know, so-called
via information for the criminals,
too. Yeah. So
I heard what you said. I'm from New York.
So so-called BFE is important and has value.
You think they're stupid? That's the problem.
No.
That's the problem.
So okay.
We didn't hear the
long and short of it.
Hold on a second.
I'm from New York.
I heard you.
You think the car scenes are stupid?
No. I think that it's a very compelling case you're making. But
for everyone to move out of New York City,
what I think is pretty clear.
Can you guys go out in the hall and we can get can we finish Marshall's question, please?
If you have a metric available, you can assign resources to deal with that metric if it's measured. If you hold people accountable, and you say, listen, you're doing it for crime, why can't you do it for garbage? You know, you're doing it for redlining, which is really a marvelous thing. You know, redlining of banks. And I think that's great. I say, I don't want to go to your bank because you're not putting loans in a neighborhood, that deserves that loans. I don't want to do that. I believe exactly what you're saying, that we have to hold groups accountable, and they have to, and through public pressure, ideally, these kinds of data sets will be made available. But more is never bad. I totally disagree with your theory that if criminals know where the cops are targeting them, that's not how it works. It's, you know,
that's not how it works today, but that's how it's going to work next year.
Okay. Well, given the
I appreciate it, guys.
Oh, okay.
They're kicking us out. Thanks, Marshall.